Mom and Dad Are Fighting is sponsored by Frank Einstein and the Brain Turbo, the third installment in the hilarious New York Times best-selling children's book series filled with inventions, science experiments, and baseball-playing robots by former National Ambassador for Young People's Literature John Sheska and mad scientist illustrator Brian Biggs. That's Frank Einstein and the Brain Turbo on sale now from Amulet Books. And by Little Passports. Keep your kids busy with Little Passports, the award-winning subscription for kids. Right now, Mom and Dad Are Fighting listeners can save 40% on their first month with promo code MOMANDDAD40. Learn more at littlepassports.com/momanddad. And by BullandBranch.com, the company that makes luxury bedding affordable. Get the nicest sheets you've ever owned for about half the price of what stores and boutiques are charging. Order right now, and they'll give you $50 off a set of sheets, plus free shipping. Go to BollandBranch.com. That's BollandBranch.com, and use the promo code MOMANDDAD.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, September 10th. The Hikes for Whiners edition. I'm Allison Benedict, an editor at Slate and the mom of Harry 6, Sam 4, and Wally 2.
I'm Dan Coyce. I'm also an editor at Slate, and I'm the dad of Harper, who is 8, and Lyra, who's 10.
On today's show, we'll talk to Scott Sampson, the host of Dinosaur Train, about how to get your kids outside and appreciating the natural world. And then we'll talk to Alyssa Strauss about the hardships of summer on low-income families. Also, triumphs and fails, a listener call from a nanny, and a special Slate Plus segment on being the new kid at school. But before we get to that, some announcements. Please like us on Facebook. It's really easy. It helps Dan's ego. Go to Facebook.com.
So much.
Go to Facebook.com/MomAndDadAreFighting. Just spell it all out and press like. You can also leave us messages and chat with us there. But mostly, we just want your like.
No, we want your engagement and interaction, Allison. Jesus. And we have a live show coming up. We really, really hope that people in the Washington, D.C. area can come see us Tuesday, October 20th, for a live podcast recording at Woolly Mammoth Theater downtown. Just like our last live show, we'll have an exciting special guest. Also, just like our last live show, we're coming right up to the wire and figuring out who that's going to be. But we'll let you know as soon as we do. Woolly Mammoth is a great space. It's a beautiful theater, and we can't wait to do a show there. I think it's going to be really, really fun. Once again, it's Tuesday, October 20th. You can get your tickets right now if you are a Slate Plus member until 5 p.m. on Thursday, September 10th. Tickets are for Slate Plus members to buy only. You can get a show ticket for $25 or tickets to an early cocktail hour ahead of the show for $50. If you're a Slate Plus member, though, you'll get 30% off that ticket price. Use your upcoming events tool in the Slate Plus dashboard on the right side of your Slate Plus homepage to get your discount code. The link for tickets is slate.com/momanddadlive. That's slate.com/momanddadlive. Once again, Tuesday, October 20th, Woolly Mammoth in D.C. We're really, really excited. Please come join us.
If you prefer me to Dan, really, then buy your tickets, because Dan's going to be the hometown hero. Again, he's going to be like packing the stands. So
yep.
Come support me.
Yes. So everyone I know, please come and cheer for me and boo lustily every time Allison even opens her mouth.
All right. On to triumphs and fails. Dan, you go first.
Sure. I have a fail. Really, it's two fails. Actually, it's three fails. It's a whole week of fails. It's just sort of an endless series of fails that has stretched my whole life. Okay. So we just spent a week on vacation with Alia's brother and his wife and their two adorable, adorable sons who are.
This is a week of vacation after Dan went to Iceland on vacation.
That's correct.
A lot of vacation time.
I packed all my vacation this year into 1 3-week period, and then I'm just going to work myself to death the other 49 weeks. So Alia's brother and his wife are really great. They're great, great, great parents. They are so calm. They are forever unruffled. They are very careful always to talk with their children and respect them, even when they are being so difficult. And so my fail for this trip is that I spent the whole trip comparing my parenting to theirs. Or really, my fail is that I compared my parenting to theirs, and that I just always was so sorely lacking in those comparisons. This was really driven home to me one day when Emily, my sister-in-law, got upset with her older son. He's three, and she spoke sort of sharply at him. And later, she apologized to him so sincerely and so sweetly for yelling, even though she didn't even yell. And the whole time that she is doing this, my kids are watching the scene unfolding before them as if it was happening on some different planet, as if it was the weirdest TV show that had ever been placed on a screen in front of them. And when it was done, when she was done apologizing to Charlie for how she spoke sharply to him, Harper was like, "Oh, don't be sad, Charlie. Our dad yells at us all the time." Actually, I guess my fail is sort of threefold. So it's comparing my parenting to theirs. It's lacking when I do so. And then also being unable to stop myself from thinking, "Oh, just you wait, Emily. Someday you'll yell at those kids all the time." Because actually, I bet she won't. I bet she won't yell at those kids all the time. Anyways, I both enjoyed the trip so much, and also I felt like a dick the whole entire time.
Yes.
My kids asked Charlie if he wanted an Oreo, and he said, "What's an Oreo?"
That didn't make you feel bad about yourself. That made you think he's going to be a weird kid.
No, he's not. He's so nice.
I'm sure
God.
Is. I believe that your very first fail ever on this show, oh so many years ago, decades ago, was about yelling.
Oh, was it? I'm really good at yelling. I'm so great at yelling at my kids. Even on vacation, like when we're all relaxing, I still find ways to just get so frustrated with them.
Did you actually feel, though, like your sister-in-law should have apologized to her son for being a little annoyed at him?
I feel like if you can manage to create a family in which everyone always talks to each other with respect and does not have to raise their voice, such that if you do raise your voice, you then later apologize for that. I feel like that seems great.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. We have a problem. Our problem goes both ways in our house, for sure. We yell a lot, and they also yell at us a lot.
Right.
Okay, well, I've got a fail, too. And my fail this week is that I cannot stop myself from asking my kids about their day, even though they clearly do not want to talk to me about their day, and they hate it when I ask, like, hate it. Nothing ruins a fun, like, mom and son chat at the end of the day more than me asking really just, like, simple questions like, "What did you do at school today?" or "How was your day?" or worse, probably more specific questions like, "What's recess like at your new school?" or "Are you meeting some nice kids?" Harry, in particular, really hates this line of questioning. I think probably because he can sense my desperation to know his innermost thoughts and feelings. Even though I tell him, all I want to know, just answer, like, good or bad. But he won't even give me that. My day was good or my day was bad. And I tried for a while really hard to stop asking. But now that they've started new schools, I find myself slipping back into it. And I noticed it especially yesterday because John picked up Harry from the bus stop. And later I was texting with him and I asked him how Harry's day was. And he said, "No clue. I didn't ask him." because he knows, like, it just creates tension to ask him. It's better, like, just not to ask him. He was like, he seemed fine enough. And I'm guessing that if I didn't ask, the boys would probably let things about their day slip out, or maybe they wouldn't. I don't, you know, but then we'd just be in the same place we are now.
Do you think that their reluctance to talk about it is greater than that of other kids? Do you think there's something about the interactions with you over time that has made them, like, dread this question? I feel like my kids and most kids I know, like, if you ask them, they'll be like, "Oh, I don't know." But they don't. It doesn't make them miserable when you ask them.
Harry will, like sort of fall over and go, or he'll say all the
like
questions.
Like Paul Rudd in Wet Hot American Summer.
Yes, exactly. Sometimes he'll trade. He'll make a deal with me where, like, he'll answer a question if I'll answer a question. I don't know. I mean, it's definitely become a thing. You know how, like, something can become a thing in your family.
Yeah.
It's definitely become a thing between us. And so I need to just leave it be and just stop asking them. And, like, I don't know. Am I really going to find out about their day anyway? Like, probably whatever answer they're going to give me is not going to be, it's never going to be enough for me.
Right. It won't be the 8 hours of full immersion in their day that you secretly really wish you could have, though not with interacting them the whole 8 hours.
But I wonder if listeners have advice for how I could maybe frame my incessant questions differently, or just how to find out how my kids are doing without actually, you know, getting them to answer my questions. Let me know.
Because maybe you should, I mean, it seems like you should just come up with some totally absurd, completely unrelated question to ask them that can instead become like a pleasant thing that you do. And maybe eventually that leads into discussion of their day or discussion of some other thing. But can you ask them what happened on this day in 1642? I don't know. Like, is there some, there's got to be some weird, crazy thing you can ask them that will get them off their dread that you're going to ask them about their day.
Yeah, that's not a bad idea. I got to figure out what that question is, but that's, yeah. That's kind of a good idea.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Kind of. Thanks. Thanks for that begrudging admiration for my kind of good idea. All right. Let's move on to a message from our sponsor. Frank Einstein and the Brain Turbo is book three in the hilarious science-themed children's book series from Amulet Books. It is perfect for fans of Diary of a Wimpy Kid. It's great for new chapter book readers who are looking for something funny and also kind of smart to read. The New York Times bestselling team of John Sheska and Brian Biggs have created a unique world of fun, integrating real science facts with adventure, humor, and obviously, robots. The six-book series follows the adventures of kid inventor and scientist Frank Einstein, his best friend Watson, and his two robots, Clink and Clank. And book three, Frank Einstein and the Brain Turbo, is a quest to unlock the power behind the science of the human body to help his friend be a better baseball pitcher. It is full of cool human body facts, full of cool John Sheska illustrations, full of fun. Check it out, Frank Einstein and the Brain Turbo. All right, let's move on to our first topic, kids and nature. So we just got back from Iceland, our family did, which is a place filled with natural splendor, waterfalls and volcanoes and waterfalls and glaciers and then like another 10 waterfalls. Our kids were really enthusiastic and excited about the world that we saw all around us on that trip. But now that we're home and they are back in school, they seem once again totally divorced from the natural world. They're stuck on screens. They're stuck in classes. They're generally stuck inside. Scott Sampson is a paleontologist and the author of How to Raise a Wild Child, The Art and Science of Falling in Love with Nature. Parents of littler kids might know him best as the host of PBS Kids' Dinosaur Train. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how's it going there, Dan and Allison?
This is the first time we've talked to someone on this podcast who my kids are going to be like, oh my God, that guy? This is very exciting.
Awesome. So, Scott, in your book, you make a really great case for not just why love of nature is a nice thing for kids to have or a nice thing for kids to connect to, but why it's really crucial for kids. It's not just that it makes them like more chill and more cool, although of course that's a side benefit, but what are our kids losing right now due to how little nature is part of their lives?
Well, the disconnect between kids and nature deserves to be at the forefront of the crises that we talk about in our country at this time. The average kid today spends 4 to 7 minutes a day playing outdoors, which is on the order of 90% less time outdoors than their parents had. And that same average American child is looking at screens for 7 to 10 hours a day. Now, in the face of it, you might go, okay, who cares? We're more of a technological society. But a recent U.S. Surgeon General said that this generation of kids may be the first to have a life expectancy shorter than that of their parents. Obesity, attention deficit disorder, heart disease, depression, all these conditions and others are skyrocketing in kids today. And getting outside isn't going to be a panacea, but it's a huge step in the right direction. And it turns out that all the recent research backs up the fact that nature deserves to be on par with literacy. We all read to our kids, and we have our kids read to themselves. We respect that as a key thing. We look at nature as something that will fit in on the weekend if there's time. But it turns out that time outdoors in nature is critical for kids' minds as well as their bodies, their imagination, their creativity, their socialization. All these elements are impacted by abundant time spent in local nature.
One of my favorite parts of the book, you know, it's full of practical advice and games and activities, and a lot of them revolve around the sort of what you call the two big ideas that can give kids a framework for understanding the natural world, which is one of the most important parts about getting them excited about it. And those two big ideas are interconnectedness, sort of the ecology of the world, how connected we are to all living things around us, and evolution through time. Can you tell us about those and what some activities are that you've come up with in this book to help parents teach kids about those two big concepts?
Sure. Very few of us, adults or kids, recognize the deep level of interconnectedness that we share with the natural world. To give just one example that science has only demonstrated in the past decade or so, we all think about ourselves as isolated beings, that there's this thing called me, I'm Dr. Scott the paleontologist or whatever, and I am one being out there in the world. Well, it turns out that's not true, that your body and mine is made up of about 100 trillion cells, and 90 trillion of those cells are not human. They are bacterial or fungal, that we are actually walking colonies, that there's more living things on and in us than there are people on Earth, than there are stars in the Milky Way galaxy. So that just speaks to the deep level of interconnectedness. And there's all kinds of activities you can use with kids to get them outside thinking about these things. If you, when they're eating dinner and they're thinking about that food becoming part of themselves, remind them and get them to think about where that food came from. If it's a chicken, well, that chicken had to eat plants, and those plants had to grow from the energy of the sun. So everything is interconnected to allow that chicken to appear on the plate in front of you and nourish your body. With regard to the evolution thing, it's pretty remarkable that we are perhaps the first culture in human history that lacks an origin story as a culture. That yes, people who follow major religions have origin stories, but many of us in Western culture today don't have any such story, despite the fact that science provides us with the framework of a narrative that is absolutely astounding and, to the best of our knowledge, absolutely true. And that is that we are all made of stuff from stars. That we, the stars and galaxies had to come first, and then planets, and then chemistry, and then life, that we're made up of bacteria, that we went through all these transformations to become the human beings that we see today. And so we're part, we're literally enfolded into this 14 billion year epic that is all around us every day. That the characters of this story surround all of us wherever we live, that wherever you live, there's a star, the sun, there's a planet we're standing on, there's bacteria, there's trees, there's animals, there's plants. It's all, that whole story is right there in front of us. We just don't think about putting it together into a narrative.
Both of those really strike me as having a lot to do with what I have always viewed as one of the great benefits of getting kids involved with the natural world, which is a reminder of how much there is outside yourself, a reminder of how, I mean, we spend a lot of time reminding our kids how important they are, which is important in many ways and beneficial, but I often find it's useful to remind them how much there is that isn't them out there in the world and the universe.
Yeah, I think that that this generation of parents, and my goodness, I'm one of them. I have a daughter who just turned 13 4 days ago, and we always tell our kids how great they are and they can be anything they want to be in the world and all of that. And I think your point is very well taken. We need to balance that with talking to kids about how much gratitude that they need to feel towards the world around them, how that they're so fortunate to be here, that they depend on the natural world around them just to survive, for food, for water, for air, all these things. They don't just come from the grocery store or out of the tap, that they're actually out there in the communities around us, and we need to understand and support those communities.
Okay, so let's get to some practical advice. I have little kids. They're 2, 4, and 6. And whenever I take them for a hike, they whine, like, terribly. How do I fight through that?
Okay, well, the first thing is never go on a hike with kids. That is, never call it a hike.
It's God,
call
Allison.
It a hike, and believe me, I've done that. I've taken my daughter out in, you know, at the age of 7, 8 years old, and I say, okay, we're going to hike to the top of this hill. She can run all day long, but within 2 minutes, she's going, Daddy, my legs hurt. And so right there, I've committed the huge error of just saying we're going to go on a hike. Instead, talk about it as an adventure. You're going to head out on an adventure. Second thing is, don't worry about the destination. As adults, we're always so goal-oriented that we want to get to that lake or the top of that mountain or whatever. And when you're with kids, especially little kids, it's way more important just to indulge them and keep their interest going. Get them thinking about birds. How many different kinds of birds can they hear or see on the walk? That keeps them occupied. You know, how many different kinds of plants can they see? What can they observe? What can they hear or feel that they might not be able to otherwise? Get them using their senses, and they're going to forget about the fact that they're actually out there on a hike. So I think turn it into an adventure and keep it fun would be my my two bits there.
So my kids are a little bit older than Allison's. They're 8 and 10. And the real battle we're fighting right now when we're not in Iceland is screens. And you talk about this some in the book. And one thing I liked about the book was I had a bunch of really great suggestions for not just throwing your kids' screens in the garbage, but using technology and the internet to help them get more excited about nature. Can you talk about some of those?
Sure. The last thing I'm arguing is that we need to go back to nature and throw away all the technology. That isn't going to happen, and nor should it. That what we need to do is balance the technology and the nature a little bit more. And right now, they're just not balanced. Right now, technology is outweighing nature by a lot. So lots of ways to do this. Photographs are one way. Get kids taking digital photos of what they're doing and then maybe making photo essays or sharing those photos on social media, whatever that might be. GPS is also great. If you think about geocaching, there's all these sites, millions of geocaching sites around the world, and that turns getting out into nature into a treasure hunt. So that's terrific. And then think about, you know, using binoculars, using cell phone apps that tell you about rocks and trees and animals that can help you understand those things. And finally, when you get back home, technology can help you understand the things you saw out in nature, especially if you took pictures of them. You can make identifications and things like that. So I think the key is to embrace the technology and the nature, but sometimes turn off those screens so that kids can really open up their senses and experience the full panoply of nature that's around them.
How much responsibility do you think the schools have to get our kids outside?
I think ultimately schools have a huge role to play. I also think it's a problematic transformation just because the school system is so intransigent and it's so difficult to do large-scale change. Teachers are already way overworked, as are administrators, and they're teaching to a test, and they just don't have time to add in a lot of new things. Having said that, there are powerful models out there that demonstrate that outdoor place-based learning is extremely powerful and engages kids not only in understanding nature and becoming more pro-environmental in their behaviors, but actually kids do better across the board academically. They do better in math and English and science if they're actually learning it outside in hands-on activities. So one great thing for teachers to do is just start using the schoolyard, whether it's through a garden, whether it's through planting native plants and seeing what animals show up, whatever that might be, just use the schoolyard as a vehicle to teach art and science and English and all those things. And just by doing that, I mean, think about it. If you're a school kid, where would you rather be learning? Sitting in a classroom with fluorescent lighting or outdoors in the schoolyard? I think that almost every kid would pick the outdoor option. So the kids will be more engaged, and it turns out if they're more engaged, they learn more along the way.
For teenagers, Scott, you stress the importance of having a peer group to share experiences outdoors with. And then you also have this great idea that I wanted you to talk about for a second, for setting a challenge for teenagers. I think you even call it in the book a vision quest. What's that about, and what can parents of teenagers do to pursue that idea with their kids?
Yeah, one of the things that I argue in the book is that as adults, we need to become nature mentors. We don't need to be experts. In fact, you don't need to have any knowledge of nature. It's more important to ask questions than to provide answers. But at each age, kids need something different. And teens really need two things, the company of their peers and the ability to take risks with those peers. And so they're going to do this. Their brains are wired for them to go take risks with their peers. So why not set up comparatively safe options for these kids to go outside and have these adventures outdoors where they can be with their peers and take risks, whether this is skiing that double black diamond hill or surfing or water skiing or climbing or whatever it might be, find the thing that interests the kid and encourage them to go after it and become proficient at it. Give them training in it. One of the things that kids love, teens love especially, is to be out with other teens and without parents around. So that's why models like Outward Bound are so successful, because they get 20-somethings and 30-somethings to look after these kids and make sure they stay safe while the kids are pushing their limits and learning new things and being able to take these risks. So I think that that's the key. And that whole vision quest thing is you can't just, you know, celebrate a big transformation when a kid turns 16 without going through a process first, that, like a process of mastery. So let them master something and then celebrate that with your family and maybe even your whole community so that they feel like they have reached a watershed moment in their lives.
All right. Well, thanks so much for talking with us, Scott. The book is called How to Raise a Wild Child. It's really great. We'll have links to buy it on our show page and on our Facebook page, facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you both very much. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks, Scott.
All right. Moving on to an ad from our second sponsor, Little Passports. Does your family take a fun trip this summer? Are your kids asking, well, where can you take us next? And you're like, I already took you on 2 vacations in 3 weeks, kids. No more vacations for 49 more weeks. Well, then, spend much less than you would on a vacation and instead buy your kids a subscription to the award-winning Little Passports. Pen pal Sam and Sophia will send your child a monthly package in the mail. The first one comes in this cool little blue suitcase, and each one highlights a new global destination like Kenya or Spain or England or Israel. Your kids can follow Sam and Sophia's journey on the wall-sized world map, which also doubles as a cool piece of art for their room wall. And they can learn more about the world through letters from Sam and Sophia, through souvenirs, stickers, and amazing little activities that kids can do by hand, and more. They'll learn how to say hello in different languages, what foods are popular around the globe, and what animals are native to different countries. Little Passports is a great way to get your kids excited for future travel or to teach them about the basics on countries in the news. And you, Mom and Dad Are Fighting listeners, can save 40% on the first month today with the promo code MOMANDDAD40. That's MOMANDDAD40. Learn more at littlepassports.com/momanddad.
Okay, let's move on to our listener call. Each week, we take one of your calls and try to answer it. If you have a question for us or one you'd like us to find an expert to answer, call us. Leave us a message at 424-255-7833. That's 424-255-RUDE. Now on to this week's call from Amy in New York City.
Hi, my name is Amy. I am currently a career nanny that's working in Tribeca for a family of 3 kids. But I was just calling in to try to gain some insight into what both of your take is on the boundaries that occur between nanny and parents and kind of figuring that relationship out, figuring out how close you want to be while still keeping certain boundaries present. I'm just going to see what you guys had to say about it.
So this listener call is really going to frustrate the listeners who email us to tell us they are annoyed at us for employing nannies, or I guess annoyed at me. Dan, have you had nannies,
but we no longer do, so our listeners love me now.
Okay. So I just want to, before we even address Amy's questions, I just want to be clear up front that we definitely realize that nannies are not the default childcare choice for many families, often because it's more expensive to hire a nanny than to send your kids to daycare. Though in some big cities, like New York, where Amy lives, that is not necessarily the case. As for Amy's question, it is hard, I think, to have any hard and fast rules about the parent-nanny relationship. From my one wonderful experience with our longtime nanny, Frida, the relationship really changed over time. The boundaries shifted. I was always wary of, you know, calling her a member of the family. She wasn't a member of the family because obviously we were her employers and watching our children was her job, not her pleasure, or at least not just her pleasure. But the nanny-parent dynamic is definitely not like other workplace employer-employee relationships. It is intensely personal. The job is intensely personal. And I really love the personal relationship that Frida and I developed, which wasn't just over the shared love for my kids, but out of a mutual respect for each other. She was really open with me about things going on in her life away from work, and I was open with her about struggles in my marriage and other things. But I know other families that have wonderful nannies who they know almost nothing about in terms of like their life outside of work. So I don't think there's one right way to relate or one dynamic that works better than others. I would say, though, that I think parents probably need to take cues from the nanny. I guess, Amy, I would be more interested in hearing from you than from talking at you. But it seems to me that in terms of boundaries, it's probably best to take the cue from the employee.
Yeah, I think that that's really important, that I feel like those boundaries are ones that when they're crossed, it hurts the nanny more than it hurts the family, right? It's, and they're crossed unwittingly from either side. And when it happens, the family might get upset for a second, but it can really damage the nanny's job or employment possibilities or their future. And if it gets bad enough that a nanny, that the environment becomes difficult or toxic, that in the end is going to impact that nanny way more than it's going to impact you, the parent. Even though it's, of course, it's a hassle to find a new nanny, that's nothing compared to the hassle of being out of a job. What we saw in our time with our wonderful nannies, we had a nanny for a year with Lyra named Molly and a nanny for a year with Harper when she was born named Merle. They were both so great and so wonderful and loved our children so much. And I think tolerated us as best as they could, is that we really had to take a deep breath sometimes and try to embrace the notion that we were not the only ones who cared about our children and not the only ones who had good ideas for ways that our children ought to be and live. And of course, you're the parent and you are the one who in the end is responsible for raising this child. But I do feel like the areas of friction in our relationship with our nannies almost always came about from us being like so clutchy and hovery and worried all the time and unable to let go at times of the things we wanted our children's day to consist of, when instead our nanny was perfectly happy to spend her time with our kids in much more easygoing ways, not rushing them from thing to thing or event to event or activity to activity. And it made for probably a calmer and more peaceful child parent nanny relationship when we sort of let go and embrace that.
How, though, I mean, that's really interesting, but I think part of Amy's question, the way I read it, was like about sort of how close to be, like,
yeah.
How, you know, where to draw the line in sort, in, you know, I remember pumping in front of Frida, like I would pump. I had, you know, she started working for us when we had Harry, and then I had Sam, and then I had Wally, and I was just, you know, boobs out in the living room pumping with her, and I think she was fine with that. I don't know that that would always be okay.
Well, that's, I mean, but you had a close enough relationship with her at that point I imagine it never seemed weird. And I imagine that you both felt totally fine with it. But you're right that it's a hard, that it depends on the family and that the cues need to come from the nanny. I think that in both cases of our nannies, we knew that these were short-term relationships. We knew that they were probably only going to be for about a year or so. In one case, because we couldn't afford to have a nanny for our kids once there was a cheaper childcare option available, which happened when Lyra turned one. And with Merle, we knew it because we knew we were probably going to move from New York around the time that Harper turned one, which is what happened. And so I wouldn't say that we got that close with them. We really appreciated what they did for our kids, and we were really, really sad when they left our lives. But we'd never really had sort of like a family relationship with each of them. And partly that was because of duration, and partly I really do think it was because both of them kept their distance a little bit in a way that it struck me as feeling comfortable for them. And we tried to respect that. We tried to help them with things in their life when they asked for it, but not to nose around in their life when they were not. And we shared things with them when they asked, but we did not try and share. We did not sort of put our problems or the issues in our life on them when it didn't directly affect them. And so, you know, you take the cues of the nanny. And if you're Amy, the nanny, I think my advice to you would be try to make it really clear to the parents what kind of relationship you want to have, and look for parents who sort of share those ideals as to what a nanny parent relationship can be.
That's good advice.
And it's not necessarily like you can sit down and say on day one, okay, here's the kind of relationship we want to have. Like, it's hard to do that in your small business employing one person and the product is the thing you love most in the world and you are feeling incessantly, like, insanely neurotic about it all the time. It's hard to be the HR department for this tiny little company you've established. But I do think that it would really benefit a nanny and a parent to at least acknowledge at the beginning of the relationship that this is going to be a work in progress, that knowing how close to be is difficult sometimes, and that knowing what the boundaries are is difficult for everyone, and expressing that out loud so later on this issue doesn't feel like the elephant in the room that you've never talked about and can never talk about. I think that that happened to us a little bit with Molly, our first nanny, where we were going into it so blind and we didn't know anything, and we didn't even anticipate the sort of issues that might come up. And it's not that we didn't establish boundaries from the get-go. It's that we didn't even really think about the fact that there would be boundaries or that we needed to worry about them. And having maybe just a short sort of setting the table conversation, if you're a nanny, initiating that conversation in the first week or so of employment might be really helpful.
I also think it's typically very hard for nannies to initiate conversations like that at the beginning of employment or at all. But it is one line of questioning during the interviewing process that's, you know, probably somewhat important, is to like the tension that you said, Dan, that you had with Merle, and I'm sorry, who was Molly, about like you sort of feeling like you needed to know everything they were doing and schedule them and, you know, be overly involved. Like, that's something that can be hashed out a bit in the interviewing process, because I think there are some nanny-parent relationships where, like, that's the dynamic and that's fine. The parents decide, like, everything the kid's going to do that day, and the nanny executes that plan. And then there are other relationships where, for instance, in our family, where, like, I didn't want to really make those decisions, and I wanted Frieda to make those decisions. And there were times when I, you know, set up a play date or said, this is an activity I want them to do. But generally, like, she was in charge. And again, like, just like all the other stuff we talked about, I don't actually think there's one right way. But I do think that that is something you can try to figure out what you want before you get into the relationship and talk about in the interview process.
Right. And select for that to some extent, or at least make it clear during that process.
Yeah. Okay. We could talk about this for a long time. I feel like the nanny family dynamic is complicated and endlessly interesting. But let's move on. First, just a reminder, call us with your listener questions, 424-255-7833. That's 424-255-RUDE. We really want to hear from you. Let's move on to our third sponsor this week. We have a new sponsor, Boll & Branch, the bedding company that has made luxury sheets easy to buy and affordable. Shopping for sheets is actually something I hate to do. I don't really like to shop in general, but sheets especially stress me out at department stores, at Bed Bath & Beyond, even at Target. It's always the same, just shelves and shelves of options. I don't know how that hits you, Dan, but it makes me shut down.
It strikes me as a delightful smorgasbord of sheets with which I might cover my bed.
Okay, well.
No, it's also annoying.
Yeah, this is actually, John and I never, I can't believe this is going to traumatize you all, but John and I never registered for bedding when we got married, because we just had like a massive blowout fight because we couldn't make a decision about fucking sheets. And why we still haven't bought a proper set.
I love that you're gonna fight about that.
Yeah, and we still haven't bought a proper set of sheets 12 years later. It's still hanging out there. But on Boll & Branch's website, it's really easy and there aren't that many options, which I like a lot. There are enough. You have your choice of four simple designs, and each design comes in a bunch of really lovely neutral colors. But all the sheets are 100% organic cotton, so that's it. You pick a design out of the four, you pick a color, and you buy. You can try out the sheets for 30 nights. 30 days, 30 nights. You can wash them, let them get softer, test them out. And if you don't love them, send them back for a full refund. If you order right now, Mom and Dad Are Fighting listeners, Boll & Branch will give you $50 off a set of sheets plus free shipping. Just go to bollandbranch.com and use the promo code Mom and Dad. And Boll is not spelled like a bowl you eat cereal out of or a bowl cut. It's B-O-L-L. So again, the website is bollandbranch.com, and the promo code is Mom and Dad. Okay, let's move on to our second segment. As the school year starts, your kids are probably mourning the end of summer. No more swimming at the town pool, no more daily trips to the frozen yogurt with gross toppings place, and no more camp. But for lots of families, the start of the school year means the welcome end to a significant family financial hardship and a difficult annual period for both parents and kids and poor communities as a whole. Alyssa Strauss recently wrote a piece for Longreads, which we are republishing on Slate this week, about how impossible summer can be for low-income families who can't afford camp and struggle to scrape together childcare and sometimes meals for their kids during the long stretch between the end of one school year and the start of another. She's joining us today to talk about the piece and the problem. Hey, Alyssa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So in your piece, you tell the story of one New York City mother and her daughter, but their experience seems fairly representative of what many poor families struggle with every summer. Tell us about what makes summer so hard for this family and low-income families in general.
So in this particular case, there's a number of factors that make it hard for this mom. For one, she's a single mom, so she doesn't have anyone else to help her out. Two, she's a nanny, which means she works relatively long hours because she has to be there before someone else can leave for work and is not able to leave from her job until someone else can make it home from work. And the third biggest, you know, problem with summer is the fact that camp is very expensive. And while there is some programming for low-income children around New York City, it's not nearly enough to cover the 500,000 kids who, you know, live in low-income families.
Is year-round schooling a solution here?
There are a number of people that advocate for something called the balanced school year. And you know, I feel like I'm from Los Angeles, and I have kind of negative associations with year-round schooling because I think of the year-round schooling that they tried in Los Angeles Unified School District where they tracked students. So they basically try to accommodate more students in the school by staggering who goes to school when. This is different. This is a balance, it's called the Balance Calendar, which an organization called the National Association of Year-Round Education advocates for, maintains the same number of school days that we currently have in the States, but it spreads the breaks out throughout the year. So summer would be reduced to 6 weeks, and there would be three other two-week breaks in fall, winter, and spring. And this formula has proven to significantly minimize something called summer learning loss, which is a huge issue for low-income kids. Essentially, when kids return to school after the end of summer, they are 1 month behind in learning.
So kids coming back to school right now, this week or last week, are finding that kids who didn't have as many camp options or didn't have parents who were able to really focus on them over the course of the summer are just like an average of a month behind kids who did have more options. Lower income kids are a month behind higher income kids at the end of every summer. And as you say in your piece, this adds up over the course of a lifetime to like kids just never catching up. So summer, as one person told you in your piece, summer becomes like just another obstacle for low income kids to achieve and succeed.
Right. And there's even been one study that links the, you know, summer learning loss and dropping out of school. And then there's also the additional penalty, basically, of health disadvantages for these kids, that they're also low-income children are less likely to move during the summer. So there's actually studies that show that there's weight gain for low-income children over the summer. And that you combine this with the fact that during the school year, these kids have access to two healthy or healthy-ish or trying to be healthy free meals a day during the school week. And during the summer, they don't have access to those meals.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. You know, I knew that many communities have programs to try and help this problem in the summer, the specific problem with school lunches going away. But Olympia and Raina's story, you know, sort of points out that sometimes those programs just are no help. Sometimes your life and your schedule just doesn't allow it.
Right, exactly. I mean, in their situation, neither Olympia nor Raina's babysitter could go in the middle of the day and pick up a lunch at a park. I mean, that's its own luxury.
So one thing in your piece that stood out to me was how expensive, I mean, I sent my kids to camp, I know how expensive it is, but how expensive even like the YMCA camps are. How can the YMCA be pricing these families out? And is there any kind of industry-wide push to do something about this?
So yes, for the piece, I spoke with Tom Holland, who's the chief executive officer of the American Camp Association. And he said that there is a lot of discussion going on how to make, you know, recruit non-traditional campers, low-income families, and make camp more accessible. And he said they're currently thinking of models where they seek out private donors who can basically subsidize camp. But, you know, he didn't say this directly, but it doesn't seem like it's something that's going to happen in the near future.
What would you say, Alyssa, to someone like me who really, really loves summer vacation and who clings to it because it is fun and is a happy reminder of more carefree times and gives kids a chance to unwind and chill and have new experiences and is loath to give up the glorious 12 week summers of my youth?
Well, I'd say at least, for one, at least if we adopted the balanced calendar, there would still be a six-week break, which is something that is common throughout Europe. So you'd still have a nice chunk of time to do your summery things. But it's not a 10-week break, so low-income families wouldn't be basically suffering for your long vacation, essentially.
Are there communities that have gone to this balanced schedule? Is this something that people are trying, or is this still a sort of pie-in-the-sky idea?
So David Hornack, who, again, is the executive director for the National Association of Year-Round Education, he also works in a school district that uses this schedule, and it's proven to reduce summer learning loss, and it really works well for families, the students and the parents. So it's out there, it's happening, it seems to be working. There's just, we're so stuck in our tradition of summer that doing this massive shift over to this schedule, it's going to take a lot. We just don't seem to be ready for it yet.
Yeah, there's no political movement behind this at all, and it would really require a real political movement.
Right, and wealthy. Yeah, I mean, again, people with means love summer, as they should. Except if you're me and you hate the heat and only wanted to sit in air conditioning at summer camp.
Yeah. All right, Alyssa, thanks so much for joining us. Readers, check out Alyssa's piece on Slate, and we'll put it on our show page as well.
And thanks so much to Long Reads for introducing us to the piece and for letting Slate republish it. That's a really great piece.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, let's move on to recommendations. Dan.
All right. So in the spirit of this episode, in which I have just been glorying in our wealth and privilege, we just got back from this vacation where, in addition to swimming and feeling bad about what good parents Emily and Gray are, I played a lot of games with the kids. This is, it's you get hot and you come inside, or it rains or whatever, and you end up inside playing board games. I sometimes think of these trips that we take with our kids as like a quest for a game I don't hate. I hate Sorry. Allison, do you hate Sorry?
Yeah.
Yeah, Sorry is the worst.
No one likes Sorry.
No one likes Sorry, except for children. Children love Sorry. The house that we were staying in had a new edition of the Game of Life. I hate this new edition even more than I hated the old editions of the Game of Life, because the winner is still the one who has the most money at the end, which is insane. Also, Allison, did you know that in the Game of Life you get $50,000 at the end of the game for each kid you have?
No.
That is the exact opposite of how life
if
actually
only
works.
Life, yeah.
I know. So we played some cards and we played Rummy Cube, which was fun. Thanks to you, Allison. But we found a new game that I really liked playing with my kids, that everyone really liked playing. And so when our kids would ask, could we play this, we would just say, okay, instead of being like, oh, whoa, I'm Paul Rudd in Wet Hot American Summer. I don't want to. The game is called Say Anything. There is a family edition of it, Say Anything Family Edition. We'll link to it on our show page and our Facebook page. So in Say Anything, each player gets like a little whiteboard and a little whiteboard pen. And then one person, one player, asks a question like, what movie character would you most want to invite to a birthday party? Or where is the worst place to bring your dog? And then everyone writes what they think the best answer is on the whiteboard. And you put them all in the middle, and the person who is it chooses the best one after some lobbying from the people who put that answer in the middle. So it's sort of, it's like apples to apples, or like a kid version of Cards Against Humanity, except for that you get to write your own funny or great answer instead of the game maker writing a supposedly funny one for you.
Wait, and you come up with your own questions, or the questions are there for you?
The questions are there on cards, okay. And you just give the best answer you can and try and get the member of your family to choose your answer over everyone else's. It is very simple. It is very fun. It lets kids be creative and funny and silly, or think really hard about what they know about the person in their family who they're trying to choose an answer for. Also, kids just really love whiteboards. They just love having a whiteboard to write on. They think it's the greatest. Anyways, it's called Say Anything Family Edition. It's good for, I think, maybe like 7 or 8 to, it turns out, at least 40.
That sounds really fun. Cool. That's a good recommendation.
All right. How about you?
Mine is a book for preschool and kindergarten age kids, I think roughly preschool and kindergarten age kids, that we've been reading for years, actually, in our family. But it's back in rotation lately because Sam is into it. And it's just so good. It's called Hey Little Ant. Have you heard of this book? I mean, I don't think it's ever been a popular book.
Nope, I've never heard of it.
Okay. It's by Philip Hoos and his daughter, who has the best name in the entire world, Hannah Hoos.
I'll be right back. I'm going to go change both my kids' names to Hannah Hoos.
Every time I read this book, I say by Philip and Hannah Hoos, who I believe was a teenager when they wrote the book, which was a while ago. I think it was from the 90s, so she's no longer a teenager, Hannah Hoos. She might even have a different last name now. And the illustrations are by Debbie Tilley. It's about a kid who has to decide whether or not to step on an ant. It opens with his like foot sort of raised up and an ant under his shoe raised up and an ant under a shoe. And the story is a dialogue between the ant, who's trying to get the boy to empathize with him and spare his life, and the boy who's getting pressured by other kids to just squish the ant. And the story ends up saying that it's up to you, the reader, to decide what the boy should do. And it's led to some pretty great conversations in our house about considering other people's or aunts' feelings and peer pressure. And it might also be a good book for parents who want to talk about respecting animals. But I've actually never read it that way. Like, that's not the lesson that I've taken from it to pass along to my children. But it's a great book. Hey, Little Ant.
I think that is, like, thematically appropriate, honestly, to our discussion with Scott Sampson. Like, there's actually a whole section in the book in his book about the specific problem of insects in the house and what to do about it, and how it can like be really useful for kids to catch them, talk about them, like think about where they came from and why they're there and what they're looking for, and then set them free as opposed to just stomping on them. I like that. I'll check that book out.
Okay. That's our show. Please email us at momanddad@slate.com with your thoughts about today's show, parenting tips, and suggestions for future topics. Please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and like us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/momanddadarefighting, and call us with your questions at 424-255-7833. Thanks to our producer, Ann Hepperman, and to our intern, Jesse Chazen-Tabor. Our executive producer is Andy Bowers. Mom and Dad Are Fighting is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Thanks to our guests, Scott Sampson and Alyssa Strauss. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Allison.
And thank you all for listening.